Now entering Nerdist.com.
Hi, everybody. I'm Leonard Maltin.
And I'm Jesse Maltin.
You're listening to Maltin on Movies. And at one time, the full name of this podcast was Maltin on Movies with Leonard Maltin and Baron Vaughn.
And I would say, and I'm Baron Vaughn.
That's right.
Right. And you're that other guy.
That's right.
Hey.
And we had infinite variations on that boring intro, but...
Yeah, I always wanted to call the show Malt and Peppa. You totally nixed that one.
See, times have changed, Baron. Now he's given up.
Yeah.
You could have gotten these things.
Okay. Oh, well, I surrendered, you know.
But then,
you know, Jesse is on me 24/7. So, and I would just see you once or twice a week at most. So
right.
You're less abusive than I am.
Yeah. No.
Is mostly what it is.
He has less opportunity.
That's true. Now, if he just would have moved in.
Before we go much further, I just want to say that Baron and I had a great time working together.
Yes, indeed.
On this show. And if you want to hear some of our podcasts, they're still up there in cyberspace. They're available.
In the annals of cyberspace.
Yes, or in the somethings of cyberspace.
Yeah.
In the virtual file cabinets.
If we're talking about the internet, it's really more the anals, isn't it? No.
I wasn't going there, but you did.
Yeah, that's what I brought to the show.
I know. And I had this – I had what I thought was a really clever idea for a format. And Paul Scheer got us together.
Yes.
Brought us together. And he thought we would like each other, and we did.
We did.
And
same birthday.
That we would – yes. And he thought that we would have sort of a good balance of viewpoints, or a good contrast of viewpoints, actually, about movies. But I didn't want to just review new movies. That's – everybody's doing that. So my idea was we would take a topic every week and choose one really good movie related to that topic, one stinker or turkey, if you prefer, and one sleeper.
Yes.
And we started out doing biographies. That was our first episode.
The biopic, that was the first episode. And I still talk about the podcast because people ask me when I go on the road. They're like, hey, whatever happened to that? I'm like, well, the podcast still exists. It's on Nerdist. It's a different format. But like, well, I really like the format you guys had. I'm like, yes, but it was work exhausting.
Exactly. This is what I didn't count on was that I would really have to revisit these films. I thought I could just look at my notes. Read my original review.
Yes.
Maybe watch the trailer again or a couple minutes online, and that would do it. And then I could come in and talk to you about them. No. I had to really go back and watch the film.
Surprisingly, movies are detailed.
What?
That's right.
It's like a lot of thought went into them.
And another thing that happened was once I started, I couldn't stop.
if it was
a good movie in particular, a stinker I could watch half of and remember enough that I could talk intelligently about. But a good movie or a sleeper, once I was get 45 minutes in, I wouldn't want to stop.
Well, because you're also watching it and going, oh, I remember why I like this movie.
Exactly.
Yes.
And it hits you in a different way because you're in a different place in your life.
Yep.
And you're like, oh, this is still good. Thank goodness.
So anyway, it was a good idea, but it was exhausting.
Yes.
And I forget which – I think you admitted it first.
Yeah. I was scared to admit it. And when I said that, you're like, I'm so happy you said that. I'm like, yes.
I am exhausted. That was it. Oh, man.
Oh, man. So someday in our dotage, perhaps, we'll do that again when we're not busy, which you are. You're James Brown busy. You are like you're like the hardest working man in show business.
I have to give that was great.
That James Brown busy.
Bravo, you,
I'm totally gonna use that. Not only am I busy, I'm James Brown busy.
Your business card from now on. Yeah.
All right. So why don't you recite for us what you're doing?
The things
right
I'm
now.
Working on.
Yeah.
All right. Mm-hmm. Well, third season of Grace and Frankie is up on Netflix right now. We're currently
No. Slower.
Oh,
you are a co-star.
Of the hit
TV
Netflix series.
Netflix series, Grace and Frankie, which just happens to star Jane Fonda and Lily Tomlin.
Couple nobodies.
And Martin Sheen and Sam Waterston. And you!
They got potential. Oh, yeah, and me.
And my favorite thing was when you got this and you were telling us who your character was.
Mm-hmm.
Jewish kid.
Yeah.
Adopted.
Yeah. Adopted Jewish kid.
It's like, well, this is fantastic.
Yeah. It's
this can only go well.
It's the typecasting. But even though not adopted. But... we're currently filming the fourth season of that right now.
Mm-hmm.
Then the revival, the reboot, the return of Mystery Science Theater 3000 Which is currently also on Netflix.
Yes, and which just launched to great fanfare.
Yes, thank goodness. Am I right?
People have been going nuts.
Yeah, I've been really happy about it because, you know, and I've said this before, but it still remains true. I was very nervous because Mystery Science Theater 3000, the fans are very insistent. And they're,
oh, what a great euphemism.
Yes.
One way to describe
what a wonderful euphemism.
Well, leading up to the release, you know, there was so much pressure. And I was, you know, all of us were kind of getting it from all ends, me and Hampton, Jonah, and even Joel Hodgson, the creator of the show. And it was like, you know, it's just that nerds love change when it comes down to it. They will accept it. Right? And then a lot of people have asked me about you being on the show as well. It's like, well, Leonard was on the old show. I'm like, I know.
One episode. He was on one episode.
Laser Blast.
One episode shortly after my bar mitzvah. And, right. and people are still talking to me about it.
Because the fans are very faithful to
oh
the
my
show.
Lord. Yeah.
And they know it backwards and forwards.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you know, it's always a possibility that Leonard will come back. So open invitation if we get a second season of that.
Okay.
When you get, let's be positive. When
how,
you
how
get a second
how many episodes
season.
Is your season?
14 episodes.
Wow.
And probably some movies that you know because you mm-hmm. do know all of the movies. Mm-hmm. The first episode is a movie called Reptilicus. You ever heard of that movie?
Yeah.
Yeah. Danish monster film because nothing says monsters like Denmark. Then let me think if there's some other movies you might know. Star Crash. Do you know that movie?
Mm-hmm. I know of it.
Oh, yeah. Woof. Holy bejuzmos. It's a rip on Star Wars. It's 1978, so the year after Star Wars comes out. It's got David Hasselhoff, and you forget that he's in it. Because it's not until way late in the movie that he shows up. And Christopher Plummer as well, who I looked it up, and Christopher Plummer said he did this movie because it was a free trip to Italy. He's like, if someone was going to take me to Italy, I took the job. The end.
I respect that as a choice.
Exactly.
Just in life.
Why not?
Then what else is going on? I have a show here called The New Negroes that Comedy Central is going to do as a series. It's a stand-up showcase. Mm-hmm. I've lifted that title from a book from the Harlem Renaissance. So I have to remember to tell everyone that because people get really uncomfortable with the title. And that's fine. It's supposed to make you uncomfortable. But the other thing, and one of the things that I wanted to talk about here on the podcast, is a documentary I made for the Fusion Network called Fatherless, in which I got to have the most intimate of personal journeys.
With a camera in your face.
With the camera in the face,
yep.
Right. And family is a tricky subject a lot of the time, but I figured since it would be fun to talk about this thing, you know, since the two of you are a family, I've heard, and love each other so much. And you know, from the moment I met Jesse and kind of saw your both of your adoration for each other, I was just kind of like, what a unit they are. What?
That's what people say as we walk down the street. What a unit.
What a unit. See, Baron, you bring out the funniest parts of my dad. That is
oh.
one of the joys I have.
Oh, perfect.
Around you.
I'm glad.
He
I'm
gets
glad.
Sassy. That's the thing. Around
I bring
you,
out that sass.
He gets sassy.
The dad sass.
Oh, it's so good.
Oh, yeah.
The sassy sauce. That's it. Yeah.
The sauce? Nope.
So,
I always take it to that.
So your show is called Fatherless.
Yes, yes.
And it's really good.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate
that. We watched it independent of each other.
And I told him I didn't want to talk about it. I wanted to ask you. I wanted to talk to you.
Yeah.
So we just kind of looked at each other and both went, ah, and then I knew.
And we don't want to give away too much because that's part of the appeal or the intrigue of the show, if you will.
We don't know what happens.
We don't know what happens. We don't know how it's going to turn out, and neither do you.
Oh, yeah. No, I did not know what was going to happen. Yeah. So to give a brief, should I give a brief little?
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
Sort of thing. So Fusion is a channel that they're pretty interesting. They are – if you have DirecTV, then you have Fusion. I think that they're still trying to get on all the Comcast sort of providers and whatnot. But I also found out that as of June 2nd, I think, it'll be available for download. I think on Amazon Video is a place
good.
That you'll be able to get
good.
It.
Good.
And so it – I had a meeting with Fusion, and they were just kind of like, yeah, we're trying to make these documentaries. And they described them as 30 for 30s,
sure.
except comedic and with some sort of social awareness to it, some sort of issue that is in America that needs to be studied. And so if you ever have an idea about something like that, let us know. And I said, yeah, I got an idea. Where's my dad? And they were like, what? You know, they totally Mrs. Kozlowski me. And it was from there on, it was just kind of putting things together to figure out how to do this. Talking to producers, talking to directors, ended up settling on this woman named Dawn Porter, who is
whom I have met.
You've met her?
She came to my class with her last film.
What was the last? Which one?
The one about the abortion clinic.
Oh, Trapped.
Trapped.
Yes.
A very fine film.
Yeah. And
very disturbing film.
Very disturbing because it's about war against reproductive rights. She also made a film called Gideon's Army about public defenders in the South.
Yes, which won her a lot of awards.
So she said, I need to do some jokes. And then we met, kind of hit it off. And then also, I've never made a documentary.
Yeah.
So I was like, I need someone who knows what they're doing, that's a qualified filmmaker to kind of help guide me through this, because I do not know how I'm going to feel. I do not know. It's going to be hard to kind of be present to whatever's going to happen, because I had no idea what was going to happen. Had no idea how things were going to unfold. I was like, I'm just going to need the best. It would be better if I am just able to just deal with it as it goes on, instead of also being like, and you put the camera over there, and you make sure the boom mic is in my face.
I think that was a very smart decision.
All right. Well, thank you.
What year did you film?
Last year.
Last year.
Yeah. So it was sort of right at the end of filming season three of Grace and Frankie. Okay. So I want to say that we started filming probably in July of last year. So we did like a week in July and a week in August. And then October was a big month. October was when I went back to New Mexico, which is where I was born and raised until I moved to Las Vegas, Nevada. So it was like, it was a very short shoot, but so many details were happening, so many stories, so many things were coming to light that I was not expecting, that none of us were expecting.
Right.
And it was always happening in a way we weren't expecting it, while we were still trying to figure out, well, how do we couch this in a quote-unquote bigger conversation about this trope?
Which you do, I think, very, very well and very authentically. You say right up front that you address the idea of being or not wanting to be a cliche or a statistic.
Yes.
And yet –
and yet I fit the description.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And that's exactly what I'm going for, is that it is this trope in the country of, you know, the quote unquote fatherless black child, and then people assume things about you if that's the situation you've been. Mm-hmm. That you're gonna act a certain way, you're gonna be a certain way, you have certain things to prove, you're gonna be angry about certain things. And I have been told these things about myself my entire life. Mm. So I was like, but I aren't and I'm not. And I won't give up the sugar. That's a Janet Jackson song.
These are the things.
Leonard, huge Janet Jackson fan.
Huge.
but
beyond words.
Beyond, I'm not even going to talk about it. That's how big of a fan I am. So I wanted to kind of show that while I fit this description, that I also don't fit a description.
Right.
And that's one of the things I think we achieved.
But it's a leap of faith on your part to be willing to do this. It really is like working without a net, to use a tired metaphor.
Very true, though.
But it's true, because you didn't know how this was going to turn out.
Yeah.
You had gotten your mother's you had enlisted your mother's support and involvement.
Yes.
So you knew you had that, and the two of you are obviously very close.
I loved watching you and your mom.
She's great.
I loved it. Because
she's
the fact
great.
That when you were singing together, when you would just go to make – and you'd make a joke in unison. Because as much as you've said that my dad – like that's how – what for me, watching you and your mom, it's the same thing. Like I can't imagine what would happen.
It's sort of why I actually like – it's the dynamic that I do kind of see with the two of you. Which is just like, oh, they kind of have a thing like me and my mom have a little
when
bit.
When you sing – when the car turns off and you see the car as a theme song.
Yeah.
It just made me smile.
Oh, I'm glad.
It really did.
I'm glad.
But we can't say how it turns out, because that, as I say, that would not be kosher.
It's still unfolding. I can say that much.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
It is a TV doc, so it's 44 minutes.
Oh, that was fantastic.
With commercial breaks. There are a lot of things that I wanted to go a little deeper into.
Mm-hmm.
But I can tell you this. These are things that – so I – grew up without a father, you know, and it was me, my mother, and my grandmother, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of fashioned father figures out of things that I saw on television, people I saw on TV. And, you know, that's actually one of the big reasons I'm into movies and media and stuff like that. Actually, recently, I've been getting hit up on the internet, on Twitter and Facebook a little bit by this guy who, his name's Don, and he and his uncle Kim had a store, had a video store in Las Vegas called Cashback Video in the old little neighborhood I used to live in. And he was just like, I would have never thought that this 11-year-old, this 12-year-old boy used to come into our store and rent video games and movies would be you, that you would turn out to be how wow. crazy. And these two men were very instrumental in my knowledge. And it all starts with the Muppet Babies is what it all starts mm-hmm. with. Yes.
What more do you need?
What more do you need?
Muppet Babies are the best.
Because as you might know, there was a song from the 70s called Rock Me Amadeus. Mm-hmm. I want to say Falco is the name of the person who sang the song. Then they did a parody on it in Muppet Babies called Amadagas. Now me, being a kid that didn't know nothing from nothing, went into this video store, saw a box that said Amadeus, and thought, that must be what they're referencing on the Muppet Babies. Because I was also a fan of MST, so I understood sometimes like the references are what educate. Like sometimes you get a reference and you're like, what does that mean? And then later you're like, that's what they meant. Mm-hmm. It's the same with Simpsons. It was like I would hear these references and then later learn the actual history or the reference that they were making and be like, oh, I got to watch that. So I saw Amadeus and I remember I was renting a video game, probably like a Sega Genesis game, and I put the game, it's probably like Mickey Mouse Castle of Illusion or something.
So good.
Right? Great game. And then I put Amadeus, and they were looking at me like, really? I was like, you want to watch this?
Do you know how long this is?
Yeah, do you know what this is about? I'm like, no, I want to see it. And they're like, okay, all right.
So one of the Muppet Babies' name was Salieri? Is that how that all comes together?
Yes, the greatest frenemy of all history. that's what Salieri is, frenemies. But it was Rolf, I guess, right? Amadagas. And I watched that movie, and it is the first drama that blew my mind, that I wasn't rolling my eyes at, and it still to this day is one of my favorite films.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of, if you will, changed my life watching that movie at that age. And then those men at that video store were so just kind of like, oh, you watched that. Well, you should watch this and you should watch that. And they were just like, I had that experience with these people. So it's just kind of crazy that they've come back into my life in a way. Who, while they were kind of father figures to me in a sense, they were the video store guys and they seemed cool to me and they knew all about all these movies. And so they kind of like tutored me, I guess, in fine films and stuff whilst I watched all the things on TV and loved comedy, you know, modeled myself after people like Richard Pryor and Eddie Murphy and Robert Townsend as well, which does come up in the doc as well.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
There, I wrote this down because you said Eddie Murphy and Richard Pryor, and there was a brief shot of Bill Cosby.
Yeah. Heathcliff Huxtable more than Bill Cosby, I'll
there
say.
You go. but when you said all the Wayans brothers, any of the Wayans brothers, 1, 2, 12 of the Wayans brothers, I just cracked. I cracked.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
It's another one. This is for our audience. Baron has a power over me where I think everything he says and does is funny.
Get out of here.
So the problem is when I'm around Baron, I can't stop laughing long enough to speak words because he cracks me up.
Oh, I'm glad.
And then the
Thank
fact
you.
That you bring the sassy out of Leonard is just like the most glorious bonus that exists. And
by the way, great name for your next book.
Right.
Sassy out of Leonard.
Sassy out of Leonard.
Maybe we'll...
It's a memoir.
Kick that around a little.
We'll talk about... See, he's easier to manipulate now.
We'll kick that around just a little bit.
But my dad also learned a lot from you being a comedian and an actor, and it sort of gave him insight.
We haven't talked about this yet today, and people should know this. You haven't mentioned your other career as a stand-up.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
But
or your background as an actor.
Musical theater.
Oh, yeah.
Musical theater. I actually text you. So when you sent us a link, Baron sent us a link to watch the documentary. And when you sent it to us, it opens and you're doing this like Michael Jackson dance move.
Yeah.
And I text you and I was like, what the hell? You never told me you could do that. Because here I am. I'm like, oh, yeah, Baron's a great singer. and Baron is really, really funny, and he's a really good actor. You dance too? Like, stop it.
Just a little bit. Only a little bit on the dancing.
A little. I'm sorry. You were definitely popping and locking throughout the film. Yeah. So
I keep that one to myself.
I know. But and anyone else who watches will see it.
I'm a Renaissance man.
You are a Renaissance.
And by that, I mean I'm Danny DeVito. And I'm teaching a bunch of people from the Army about Shakespeare. That is a good movie.
I just watched it the other day. It was on TV.
It's fun.
Remember Stacey Dash when she wasn't insane? That was fun.
I think the seeds were there.
Yeah.
Well. But so you were talking about stand-up, though.
Yes. Now you've used your, obviously, your life experience, mm-hmm. The fact that you didn't have a dad as fodder for, oh, dear. There's a bad pun.
I use my father as fodder. Oh, hello, fodder.
Wow. Oh. Wowee.
he shocked himself.
Wowee, I did.
Well, you didn't mean it as a.
I didn't, but I said it, and there it is. And now it's out there in cyberspace.
Hey.
Yet again.
You can never take it back.
One of those file cabinets.
It's in the annals of cyberspace.
That's right. And you had to repeat it. So. But you've drawn on that material for your act.
Yes.
Talk about that, and what's that like? I mean, you're digging into something that's very serious to you.
Mm-hmm.
But like everything in life, there's absurdities. Mm-hmm. There's there's humor everywhere, even in the most serious things.
Yeah, yeah, and absurdity and silliness. Mm-hmm. Are the things I like to traffic in, I mm-hmm. guess, in general. Mm-hmm. So I do try to take things that are real from my life or the world and look at them through that lens, mm-hmm. which has to do, again, with like the things that I was absorbing as a young person, because also one of the most important movies I ever saw, I watched because the name Baron was in the movie, and there's no one with my name except Baron Trump now, which sucks.
Oh.
When people are like, oh, like Baron Trump, I'm like, no, at least Baron Davis, and I don't even watch basketball. He doesn't play anymore. It was The Adventures of Baron Munchausen, right? Yeah. A Terry mm-hmm. Gilliam directed film, and I knew Terry Gilliam as a director before I actually even knew who Monty Python was.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that movie, which is one of my favorite movies, and I still love it for sentimental reasons, because the last time I saw it, I was like, it does take 30 minutes for this to start. It is a long time before you're like, what's happening here? Because I tried to show it to someone, and I'm like, this takes a little bit. But it's so fantastical, and it kind of informed the way I think about things. And then, of course, watching someone like Pryor, who was so autobiographical and was able to put all of it out there, because my girlfriend never really watched Pryor.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried to show her a little bit of Live in Concert, which was the one in Long Beach before Live on the Sunset Strip.
Yeah.
And I was like, he's amazing, right? And she's like, yeah, but my heart. He's clearly in pain. I'm like, yeah, but it's funny, though. She's like, yeah, but my goodness, what did he have to go through? I'm like, yeah, but he's hilarious, right? And I just never saw that because I was always, looking at the comedy part. So I guess someone like Pryor influenced me to talk about myself. But then all this silly stuff and all like MST and, I've talked about MST and The Simpsons and Baron Munchausen kind of influenced me to filter that through the lens of silliness,
mm-hmm.
I guess you could say. So that's what I try to approach in my stand-up. It's gotten more autobiographical as of late because of this documentary.
Sure.
It's the first time that I've ever delved into things that I was sort of taught not to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
Because these events surrounding my birth were things that were very painful for my mother.
Sure.
So it kind of was like, he's a baby. We're not going to tell him. He's too young to understand. And I got older. It's like, he's still a baby. He's not going to understand. And then they had no practice talking about these things. So by the time I could understand, they didn't want to talk about it. And in some sort of way, not having this information is what kept me a child.
Mm.
In some kind of psychological way, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm.
So having a lot of this information for the first time is what helped me grow up like that. Even though I don't like all of the things. I don't like all of the way things happen, all the ways things happen. I don't like all the information. I don't like the way that everyone was treated, especially my mom. But it is what happened. And just knowing that helps me kind of put it to pasture.
Now, has she seen the film?
She has seen the film, and luckily she actually, you know what, now that I think about it, I'm not sure. I mean,
you show an earlier version of it, or
I invited her to. We did a little screening here in LA, and I invited her to it, but she wasn't sure that she wanted to mm-hmm. be there.
Yeah,
because she, unlike myself, is not an actor.
No. To do that publicly, to be with other people
who just saw your baggage.
Yeah,
you know, yeah.
That would be very tough.
Yeah,
I think that would be very tough.
And you know, I feel like she told me she saw, but we haven't talked about it at length, what she saw. Mm-hmm. We have talked about what happened, you know, and I've checked in with her a lot of times about how you're feeling about what happened. Are you, how are you feeling about some of the things that are happening now since we've made it? And she's been fine about it, you know. I think for her, this doc and making it was also healing for her to kind of look at these things. And to kind of go, oh, I made it. You know, I triumphed over adversity, if you will.
Yeah.
And like, I don't have to be afraid to talk about these things because mm-hmm. it's over.
Yeah.
And that was a big thing for her as well.
Yeah. I would think it would lift a weight.
Yes. And I think it has. It's created a new openness that we haven't had. Because the relationship you saw in the film, it was a long road to get to that.
Yeah.
You know, because of some of these things, like some of the things I would have wanted to go a little deeper into to get dark, this is like when it gets dark, I start to get silly, you know, is stuff like my childhood wasn't perfect, you know, not that anyone's is, but like there was some hard stuff because she had a lot of emotions that she didn't know how to deal with. She didn't have the tools to deal with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I would have liked to have gone a little deeper into like mental health and abuse and some of the things that when you are being ignored and invalidated and people aren't supporting you, some of the things that can turn into, which did happen for my mom in some ways and was informative to my childhood as well. But we dealt with a lot of that stuff. Her and I kind of mm-hmm. worked on it, you know, when I was in college, kind of actually in the same year that I started doing stand-up. Mm. And it's been such a huge thing to kind of grow past.
Well, not to be an armchair psychiatrist, but why do you think you started doing stand-up?
Well, you know, I've kind of put it in the way that, like, I looked to a lot of these comedians as fathers in a way mm-hmm. and saw that they were getting laughter, mm-hmm. which starts with an L and so does love. So I was kind of like, hey, I can get that. And I wanted to be like my dad's, quote unquote, my dad's. Yeah. So I sort of went into the family business in a sort of a way.
Right.
And does that make sense?
Yeah.
Of course. No, okay. Who doesn't want approval?
Yes.
And this is a kind of mass approval.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I find it fascinating because you've got generation and location. And that's what I always say to my mom because both parents grew up on the East Coast.
Yes.
And the generation they're in is one that doesn't talk about feelings. Then my parents moved before I was born, moved me to LA, the center of feelings. Like, capital of feelings, and every school has a counselor that you have to see, and you have to talk about your feelings.
Oh, interesting.
And in school, if you're doing poorly – so because I was dyslexic and I never did well in school, they kept sending me – not my parents, but the school kept sending me to psychiatrists and therapists.
Oh.
I had to see educational therapists. And so then I would
come home.
And
did that help identify dyslexia, or was it still a while?
It was awful. But I would then come home and be like, let's talk about your feelings. And my mom's like, what feelings? Feelings aren't a thing. What are you talking about?
Oh, goodness.
But it's fascinating in that it's the location and the generation of my – you know, you come from a generation like your mom did where it's like, we don't talk about this stuff. And then you move into this world where people are brutally honest in the sense of stand-up.
Even to the extent of oversharing.
Oh, my Lord. I don't know how recently you've seen South Park, but every time Cartman talks about female comedians, he goes, women are funny, get over it. My vagina. And it kills me.
Who's he supposed to be quoting there, I wonder? I
can't begin to imagine. But that's it. I think it's being here and being around all these creative people where emotions are right at the surface all the time because they have to be.
Well, that's actually an interesting point because I feel like when I was in New York, you know, and it's different for you, of course, because you grew up there.
Yeah.
And so New York is home. But it's like New York is very everyone is moving at a pace that there's not really any time. You know, it's just like everyone's just kind of going.
Yes.
And in L.A., you spend a lot more time alone, I feel like.
Yeah.
Because in New York, even if you're traveling, you're still in the subway.
Yeah. Oh, yeah,
you're still walking.
You're dealing with humanity.
The
minute you
times.
Walk out your door.
Yeah.
Whereas in L.A., you're isolated in a car. And it's a huge difference, an enormous difference.
Yeah, and I think that is the kind of thing that, for me at least, helped bring me a little bit more introspection.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Driving around, thinking about my feelings, listening to podcasts, you know, being like, they're talking. Yeah. Why can't I?
Let's bring it back to movies for a minute.
Yeah.
What other movies had a real effect on you, an influence on you in your formative years?
Well, I talked about Pryor as well a little bit earlier, and my first exposure to him was as an actor.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was probably the original 5 years of SNL where he hosted it so much I thought he was actually a cast member.
Mm-hmm.
But I followed him into certain movies, and one of the early movies, and it's a sentimental favorite, is The Toy.
Mm-hmm.
And Brewster's Millions. These are... Mm-hmm. Not looked at as the best movies in the Richard Pryor canon.
That would be true.
But they're the ones that, first of all, Richard Pryor's a really good actor.
Like
he's great in both of those movies, even though they're kind of ham-fisted when it comes down to it. Brewster's Millions, a little less so than The Toy. The Toy, there's a pork hand. It is ham-fisted. But it is... Still, there is the themes of fatherhood are there
right.
a lot in that movie. He is simultaneously, if you don't know The Toy, basically the premise is Jackie Gleason, which also, by the way, it was a big draw to me, was mm-hmm. Jackie Gleason is a comedic genius.
So funny.
Richard Pryor is a comedic genius.
Yeah.
Putting them together, I get curious. Yep. I'm already curious.
Should have worked better.
Should have worked better. I will agree with you on that one.
Yeah.
But I was still like, well, I want to see.
Yeah.
So the premise is that Jackie Gleason plays a character named U.S. Bates, who is a very, very rich man. I guess, you know, kind of like to a Rupert Murdoch kind of, you know, extent, a kind of a Hearst kind of extent. And he's a newspaper mogul as well. And he has a son who I guess the idea is that he's divorced and that he's sharing custody of his son with someone else. But his son comes to visit, and because he's a man who isn't necessarily in touch with his feelings, he's always showering his son with gifts and toys. And he owns a department store. So he's like, go to the department store and anything you see that you want, you will have. And the thing that is the most entertaining to him is the night janitor at the department store, played by Mr. Richard Pryor, of course. Who we see is an aspiring journalist, actually, and wants to be more than a night janitor, obviously. Mm. The son sees this guy and is like, I want him. That's who I want. And it's, of course, everyone's like, isn't slavery over? This is going to get weird, but there's still, 55 more minutes of this movie. So Pryor's character jumps at the choice because it's a ridiculous amount of money that he's making. Mm-hmm. And he's thinking, I can parlay this into something else. But then actually starts to have a relationship with the son, and seeing that the son never really got a relationship with his dad because his dad is so busy working. And then so he kind of fathers the boy and then teaches the father to father the boy.
See, this is so interesting because your description, your description of the movie is so much more empathetic
than the actual movie.
Yeah. Movie is,
but
that's why movies are so personal.
Yeah,
they are so like a book.
Yeah,
they're so personal. So it's no shock that movie meant something to you.
Right.
This is also though why when I was saying that my dad learned a lot from you, he didn't realize why. We've talked about it even on our show all together that comedians tend to be really good dramatic actors.
Sometimes.
There's a failure in every bunch.
Yeah.
But this was something that my dad hadn't thought about and hadn't put it into words.
Mm.
And then because you guys would discuss it, it sort of became a lot clearer to him. And
I'm happy I could help in this description.
It's like it's another one where you're going, well, but here's another side of it and here's
yeah, and else. Look, everything I'm saying about that movie, if you watch the movie, you'll be like, oh, I see it. But it is not as it's not really the point of the movie as much as anything else.
It doesn't matter. It's what it is to you.
Yeah, it's kind of like the writers are just kind of like, just put Richard Pryor somewhere and it'll work. Like Superman 3. Just get Richard Pryor and it'll work.
Yeah. And Brewster's Millions. Now, The Toy was based on a French comedy.
Oh, I didn't know that.
But Brewster's Millions is based on an old stage play,
mm-hmm.
and it had been filmed something like four times already or five times.
Yeah, I think there were
already,
like a couple different versions of
and,
it.
And so that was considered a surefire property. You know, you can't go wrong with Brewster's Millions.
Just put Richard Pryor in it and we'll be fine.
Just put Richard Pryor there and you're home free.
And it kind of works. But it's still a movie where I relate to that movie because that whole movie is about – the premise of the movie is – Richard Pryor finds – first of all, he's kind of like a minor league baseball player playing for a team called the Hackensack Bulls, which Hackensack is in New Jersey. And
right next to the town I grew up in, Teaneck, New Jersey.
Hey, there you go. Boom. Already autobiographical.
Already. A point of reference.
And he finds out that he has a really rich uncle that dies but wants to teach him a lesson about money. So you're going to get $300 million, except – you have to spend $30 million in a month in a way where you have nothing left and no assets because I want to teach – he uses the metaphor of like my father caught me smoking cigarettes, so he made me smoke the whole pack and I learned my lesson, so I'm going to teach you a good lesson. And I want to say that's Hume Cronin who in the movie makes this little cameo and you're like, what? What's going on right here? And it doesn't really work in a lot of different ways, but it's still fun. And for me, it's because Richard Pryor has to use his wits to outsmart everybody to in the end win. A way where someone using their wits to outsmart everybody to win that works as a movie is Beverly Hills Cop. So if you want to see a movie about someone using their wits to outsmart everyone, watch Beverly Hills Cop instead of Brewster's Millions. But Brewster's Millions still I love.
And there you are. And there's something about films that you see in childhood and adolescence that stays with you for your whole life. That's I firmly believe that you have that sentimental attachment, I guess, is another cliche description for it. But that's what it is.
Yeah.
It burrows into your consciousness in a way that nothing rational can dissipate. Mm. Nothing can take that away from you. And nor should it.
Right, right.
Nor should it. But then you find yourself having to defend certain movies.
Yes.
That, you know, other people say, really? You like that? Well, yeah, I saw it when I was 11. And it meant a lot to me then. And it still does.
And I know now, like, if I watch it, like, and knowing what a good movie is and be like, okay, well, the script needs a little work, but Richard Pryor's still good in it. He's always good in whatever he does.
So what's your favorite – other than those sentimental favorites,
mm-hmm.
what do you think is his best movie?
What do you think is Richard Pryor's best movie?
Excluding the concert films, which are in a class by themselves.
Well, you know, I'll say that I haven't watched all of Richard Pryor's movies. I still haven't seen what's that one? The when he plays the race car driver that I can't remember. I wanted to call it Grease Lightning.
Grease Lightning, totally.
But
I
definitely is not. That's one of his earlier films that I've heard is great that I have not seen. I have also not seen Lady Sings the Blues, which I think – did he get an Oscar nomination for?
Yeah, well, that's kind of a – that's kind
it's
of
really
a
more,
sidekick role.
Yeah, but he's still there. It's the same for a movie like The Mac where he's in it for 5 seconds, which I have seen. Which Way Is Up is interesting, which is another remake of a French film.
Movie.
Oh, Italian movie.
Yeah, Lena Wertmüller film. Yeah.
And he does three different roles, you know, kind of setting up what Eddie Murphy's going to do in the 90s with a nutty professor and all of the clumps. So,
Grease Lightning.
Oh, my goodness. It is called Grease Lightning.
That is the name of the movie.
It is called Grease Lightning. Yeah. Well, that's a Richard Pryor movie that I heard he's very good in that I still haven't seen.
Now, where would you rate, like, Silver Streak?
Oh, Silver Streak. Silver Streak is definitely at the top. It's interesting, too, because technically it's not a Richard Pryor movie, right?
No, of course not. It's a team movie. It's a comedy team that they devised.
And it's the beginning of the pairing of Wilder and Pryor.
Yeah. Mm.
Because I think that he doesn't really show up until like 25, 30 minutes into the movie. And then the movie is amazing because the chemistry between Pryor and Wilder is is just amazing.
Yeah.
And then he leaves the movie and you're like, no, why did you do that? I was enjoying this. But it's definitely one of those movies where you really start to see like that, you know, it sets up, of course, Hear No Evil, See No Evil. I mean, it doesn't set it up like as a film, but it sets up that their chemistry is good like that. What's the other Wilder?
Stir Crazy.
Stir Crazy. Oh my goodness. Stir Crazy. Yeah, but Grease Lightning is up there, definitely. I mean, Grease Lightning, Silver Streak. Sorry, some are trains, some are cars, some take place in planes, some in bars. All right,
huh? What? did I just black out?
Yes,
a little bit.
Wow, gee.
You can't say black. You have to say African American.
Oh my God,
African American out.
That's ridiculous.
Oh, you're welcome.
Oh dear,
that is very ridiculous. Oh dear, indeed.
Are you still doing stand-up? Do you have time to do stand-up?
Yes. Not as much time as I would like, but when I do stand-up, when I'm doing stand-up, I have to make the time to do it. So it's kind of like I've sort of started to think about it in a different way. Like I need to – okay, sometimes I have to take a break because of all these other things are going on. Mm-hmm. You cannot do everything at once.
Mm-mm.
But when it's time to come back to stand-up, I focus on it and I write it. So I am doing stand-up around Los Angeles because I'm still kind of in a building phase with random gigs on the road here and there.
Right. Is it tough at all playing Servo on MST
mm-hmm.
because you don't have an audience reaction?
Well, that's an interesting point. Yes, because we think the jokes are good.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, but as I always say, it's hard to tell what color your house is when you're standing inside it.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes you're too – like with Fatherless –
I'm going to write that down.
Write that down. Because even with Fatherless, like leading up to doing it or leading up to releasing it, I was like, is it good? I don't even know anymore because I've just
– Sure.
I've seen it so many times.
And yet you live with it.
Yeah.
That's the other.
Yeah.
And so with MST, it was a similar thing. But, you know, Joel is there. Joel is at the helm of the whole ship. So – we had to trust him. You know, he's like, oh, man, the jokes are so good. This is a great episode. And then we're also doing it at a pace when we were recording the kind of the riffs over the movies. We're doing it at a pace and at a clip where it's hard to take stock of what's what. But then we had the interesting experience of all the stuff that's on the Satellite of Love, the kind of the interstitial bits that are sketches where the bots are there with Jonah. Because of the relationship with Kickstarter that the whole project had, a lot of backers had donated to the extent where they could come to the set.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
So every now and then there'd be 20 people who kickstarted this thing to the side laughing, trying to not laugh loud so as not to ruin the take. Mm-hmm. But that was the thing that gave me confidence.
Sure.
Oh, that's good.
When I could see that's like, helpful. Oh, they're having a good time. These people are literally my boss. They just paid for this thing. They're having a good time. They're laughing. That's what made me feel like we're doing some good stuff here.
Oh, that's a cool experience.
Yeah. Very rare. And I doubt we'll have it the next season. But
you hope you have like one camera guy with a sense of humor.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, a lot of the crew was first of all, people who love the show coming out of the woodwork.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Had no – who tweeted about it the other day? Kirk Hammett, the lead guitarist of Metallica, was just like, hey, new Mystery Science Theater 3000. No one told me. This is awesome. And I was like, what is happening? Lin-Manuel Miranda just tweeted about it. Bobby Lopez actually wrote a song for us for the show to do.
Of course
he did. Neat.
So it's like all these people, you know, are just showing up that are like, I always loved the show. Like writers, comedians, actors, all these different personalities that I had no idea – just loved it because they saw it when they were 11 or they saw it when they were 12.
Yeah. That is why his cameo will never die.
Will never die,
and
Leonard.
The same photos pop up every single time on any of the versions of social media. And it cracks me up because I see it constantly. And I hadn't even, that's the thing, I hadn't even seen it.
Mm.
When everybody and their mother was like, oh my God, your dad was on MST. I didn't know what it was. And now I have seen it. And it is really funny and really enjoyable, but like, wow, it has its own life.
And then the other thing about it is with a lot of the riffs and the jokes, everyone's not going to get every single joke.
No, of course not.
That's actually kind of part of the charm of the show
mm-hmm.
is that some episodes you're going to get a lot of the jokes and those become your favorite episodes.
Yeah.
And then because you're laughing more.
Yeah.
And then some episodes you're not going to get as many. And those aren't your favorite episodes. But then there's a person that you know that's like, I loved that one.
Yeah.
And it's part of the culture of MST to constantly be identifying which movies are your favorite. Yeah. You know, it's kind of like you walk into someone's house and you look at their bookshelf and you go like, oh, I think I know who you are based on what you have here.
Yeah. We can be friends.
It's just sort of the same with the MST sort of fan base.
Which is why an author I read an interview with said he's really discouraged now. When he used to go on plane trips, he'd look around to see what people were reading. Now they're all holding their tablets. And he can't tell what they're reading. just a cultural shift, a slight cultural shift, but it's an interesting one.
And then to add to that, I remember a speech that Steven Soderbergh did where he's saying he is looking at what movies people are watching on planes.
Uh-huh.
And then one time he looked over and this guy was looking at his tablet and he was not watching a movie as much as he was watching a supercut of every single action sequence from popular movies. And I'm like, what? And Steven Soderbergh was like, this guy's just watching nonstop mayhem. No, he doesn't care about the characters or the stories. What's going on?
Gets into a car that looks like it's like a doom buggy, and he's just, all just fired up.
Scary. Yeah.
Now let's talk about acting again.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about your experience on Grace and Frankie. You're working with world-class people here.
Yeah.
What are you getting from that experience, and what are you – I mean, if you can even articulate it, what's it like?
Yeah, well, you know, first of all, I wear it a little bit as a badge of honor that I can keep up with people who are legends, you know, that who are – like I can have a scene with Jane Fonda and at the end of it, she's not like, fire him. I don't mess with jokers or midnight stokers. I play my music in the sun, you know, because of – some people call her a space cowboy, but
see, that'd be an example of a joke I didn't get.
And me and Aristotle are going.
Just as a random example.
Yes. Okay.
Okay. Go ahead.
Exactly. But some people at home are like, ki.
Yes.
That's how they laugh with K's and I's. So it's pretty cool to be in a scene with Jane Fonda and be like, I'm holding my own with her. She doesn't feel like I'm not giving it. You know, I feel like I'm on her level when we're in a scene together. It's the coolest thing for me is also seeing how they're on set, how they act on set, just in between takes. Hanging out with Lily and Jane, who have been friends for like multiple decades, 40, 50 years or something like that. And the kind of rapport that they actually do naturally have, which gets translated into the show. Hanging out with Martin Sheen and Sam Waterston and also getting to hear like their war stories and hear Martin Sheen. He was talking about Dennis Hopper the other day and it was Apocalypse Now and just talking about kind of how everyone was scared of him for a while. It's just kind of like he was walking around with a gun and it was just kind of like, what's going on right now? And then the talks that they had that were like where Dennis Hopper was like, maybe I need to change and like kind of went and became a different person. And so it's like interesting to hear them all talk about that, or Sam Waterston talk about the killing fields and what kind of experience that was like. So it's like, it's interesting to hear them all talk about being on different sets and all the films that they've done, but then also playing with them on camera, especially like Lily, who is a personal hero of mine. I did watch the original Laugh-In, even though I wasn't alive, but you know, Nick at Night, thanks. Thank you, 80s. And playing with her and improvising with her and doing stuff that she picks up on or she does stuff that I pick up on. And they treat me not like I'm an underling, but like I'm a peer, which is a great vote of confidence and makes me feel safe to play because I can see that they're playing as well. It's a comedy. Everyone needs to have fun.
Yeah.
So having that bright energy on set sort of it goes into the show. You know, I think people feel it when they watch it.
How cool. I'm just sitting here thinking, wow.
Yeah.
If you ever want a set visit, you totally have it.
I think I'd be intimidated.
Well, they probably all know who you are, Leonard.
No. I've met both women. I don't think I've met either of the men. But I certainly admire their work.
I really want you to go drinking with Martin Sheen. Is that wrong? I just think that would be so cool.
Well, I think I could probably help them come out here to the studio, definitely. If you guys want to sit down with a Marty or a Sammy.
We'll pass.
Yeah, right.
We'll pass on that.
Okay. Indeed. Yeah, it is because like
– Have you seen the documentary about Apocalypse Now?
No, I haven't yet.
Called
– Hearts of Darkness?
Yeah. Hearts of Darkness, the filmmaker's journey. It is pretty remarkable.
Yeah, I've seen a trailer for it, I think. When did it come out? Forever Ago?
Yeah, Forever Ago.
Okay. So I saw a trailer of it like maybe 10 years ago, and I was like, is that new? But it had been out already.
Oh, no. It's, and then I think when it came out on DVD, Eleanor Coppola.
1991.
Either did a revision or a kind of an additional piece to go with it. It's extraordinary because the making of that film was an extraordinary once in a lifetime experience for everybody for a variety of reasons.
Yes,
Mr. Sheen had a heart attack on that movie.
Oh right,
but how many did he cause?
No, not him.
No, joke.
Mr. Brando may have caused heart attacks.
Yeah.
Hey.
Mr. Sheen suffered a heart attack.
Yeah.
Lawrence Fishburne was a teenager.
Yes.
On that movie.
That's wild.
I mean, there's so many different angles, so many different things about that film that make it a landmark.
Right.
Aside from just the film itself. And so that documentary is kind of must viewing.
Oh, I will definitely watch it. Yeah. You know, another interesting thing that I forgot, Martin Sheen does not watch his own work.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
This is a thing that a lot of actors do. I personally do watch my own because I'm like, but I do criticize myself more than anybody else. I'm like, is that how I move my mouth? Or, my eyes look weird. That's probably why they don't watch, because they don't want
to. Yeah.
But I think for Martin, and Ethan Embry also does not watch his own work, I think it compromises being inside it for them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's like their job is not to watch the show. It's to be in the show.
Right.
It's to live in this reality. So they can do that, I guess, with unimpeded, what's the word I'm looking for? It's like they just they're not trying to, like, match what they've done before.
Right.
You know, or comparing themselves to themselves.
Right. They don't want to be self-referential.
Yeah. They can just be inside it without having
to
think about it.
Having come from the stage, too, he has that background and that discipline.
Yes. Which he also talks about.
Yeah.
On set. He talks about Joseph Papp and what kind of a person he was and all that stuff. And Samuel Waterston worked with him a couple times too.
Yes.
That's getting to listen to those people is such a treat. And a lot of people will never have that experience. Them or any of the folks who've been around for a long time, like, they have those war stories. Because in a lot of cases, they don't want to share them because they don't want to mess with the memories for other people.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want to say, here are all the terrible things that happened when we did this.
I do that to this day.
But but it is amazing when you can just kind of sit and absorb.
Yeah, yeah. And it's also kind of cool listening to Sam and Martin talk about their theater days.
Oh, yeah.
And talk about different people they did plays with who are now, like, you know, sometimes big actors.
Yeah.
Samuel Waterston was talking about doing Long Day's Journey in the Night the other day and with his actual son playing Edmund, I think is the name of the role. And then there's Jamie Jr., who's like the mean kind of son that everybody – that's like a big role that a lot of people want to play. And John Slattery played it.
Huh.
And I was like, whoa, I can't even imagine in my brain that production.
Yeah.
But like, yeah, it's interesting being around them and kind of playing with them with all these different stuffs.
That's just neat. You are building a resume yourself that's going to be
– Trying.
Yeah.
Well, you're getting there.
When
you're getting there pretty
any
fast.
Idea when the Comedy Central stuff for the name of the show I won't say. any idea – so you know that there was a movie that came out called I Am Not Your Negro.
Yes.
And apparently I was told by one of the publicists that was not the N-word they wanted to use in the title. And they had to explain that if you use the other one, nobody can say it at all.
Mm.
They also were giving away T-shirts that said, I am not your Negro, and my husband got one. And he doesn't have the nerve to wear it.
And that might be scary for him in certain ways, which is a great documentary about James Baldwin.
Yes, it is.
Raoul Peck, I believe, is the name of the director, who Don Porter is friends with.
There you go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it all connects in the end.
It does.
I'm not sure. Mm. We have not yet filmed it, but hopefully sometime next year it'll be out.
Oh, that's great.
Cool.
Well, you're doing just wonderful stuff.
Hey, I'm happy to be back here and talking with y'all.
Good stuff, and it's nice to have you here in front of the microphone again.
We're totally territorial of you whenever we see anything that you're in. It's like, look what our Baron is doing.
Hey, that's
fine.
Look
at what our Baron is doing.
I like having extended family.
Isn't it exciting?
It's good.
Yeah.
And I'll work on Martin and Sam for you. Oh, I'm great. Saying it out loud into the internets so that way I get taken to task.
Pile them in the station wagon.
Right? Yeah, perfect.
And bring them
over.
But yeah. Congratulations on Fatherless. It's really so. I mean, I cried. I cried and I was nervous. And you feel everything that you're feeling. And that I can't even imagine. I don't know how you did it, honestly.
Neither do I.
I don't know how you did
That's
it.
That's why I had a director there.
And, yeah. And I loved all the moments with your girlfriend going, no, don't let go of me. I'm going to need you to keep holding me, darling. I'm going to need you to not let go because losing my mind.
Also, here's a little piece of information we can go out on, right? I'm going to be a father myself.
What?
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I think in journalism terms, they call that burying the lead.
You got to keep it for the end.
Oh, my God.
You want to leave them wanting more.
Wow.
My girlfriend is due in October, which is the same month I actually met that other dude. So that's also another lead to bury. See you later.
Wowee. Well, as we say in the old country, mazel tov.
Yeah, right.
Thank you.
And,
so people can find, they can follow you, Baron Von Black.
Yeah, Bar Von Black, BarVonBlaq on Twitter and Instagram. And, Fatherless will be out there for, if you don't have cable, to see in June.
And if you do have cable...
it's on Fusion.
On Fusion.
Yeah.
Constant playing.
All right. Baron, welcome back. You're always welcome here. And that's for
Bring
real.
Us your baby!
Yes. All in good time, darling. All in good time. And, Jesse, where can folks find you?
They can find me next to you most of the time.
That's true.
At Jesse Malton, you're at Leonard Malton, and he holds court at leonardmalton.com. I gotta tell you, there's so many really, really good pieces up right now. I have been fascinated by everything that's coming out, and I'm not biased because most of the time I don't care what he says. I'm kidding. I'm kidding. No, truly, some really, really neat stuff. Ooh. So please go to leonardmalton.com and check it out.
All right. Thank you for the nice plug.
Welcome, Daddy.
Thank you all for listening, and... as always, we'll see you next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.